This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Russell Snyder is a patriot and an idealist. After September 11th, after the attacks of 2001, he signed up for the Army. But when he got to Iraq, everything changed. The war became real. He was part of a three-man psychological operations team, and what he saw and experienced changed him and shook his idealism. He had come to terms with the fact that part of the mission was to make other people suffer, and while his faith in his fellow soldiers stayed strong, his belief in the war faded. In March of 2011, he got out of the Army, went back to civilian life, but his experiences still haunt him. He started writing as a cathartic experience, but eventually that turned into a chronicle of one soldier's journey from idealism to disillusionment to a new kind of idealism. Russell Snyder is the author of Hearts and Minds, With the Marines and Alan Bard, the story of psychological warfare in Iraq. And he joins me in the studio now. Russell, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you
here. Thank you, Frank. It's good to be here.
You were 19 when you signed up for the Army. Tell me about that decision.
Well, I had entered college on a scholarship and really had no idea of what to do with my life. I picked the first major on the list, which was accounting. And I thought I could slog through it, and I found out I was really not emotionally ready. I was not mature enough for college, and I dropped out, and I thought I found a purpose in the Army. I was moved by the September 11th attacks, and I kind of thought I had a patriotic duty to do this. I had a family tradition of military service. My dad was in the Navy. My grandfather was a World War II veteran. And it didn't strike me as real, the war that is, because I'd spent the first couple years of my service in Korea. I'd been trained in Korean as part of psychological operations training and spent a lot of time in hotels. A lot of time getting into trouble, drinking and whatnot. And I was sitting in the battalion operations office one day, and I heard news that my friend John had been killed in Iraq. Yeah, this was the first time it seemed to be a part of my life. And about 2 weeks after that, I was transferred to the 9th PSYOP Battalion, which is the tactical battalion.
I said PSYOP, that's psychological operations, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I proceeded on training to California, and shortly after that to Al Anbar.
I want to ask you about this decision, because you said initially you had a sense of a patriotic duty post 9/11, but you weren't posted to Iraq, and it wasn't until your friend was killed that you realized there was something else going on. I mean, were you all this time sitting in Korea saying, "Wait a minute, I want to get in there, I want to do something"? To
initially, I did want to participate. I wanted to kind of validate myself as a soldier. And as I was sitting in these hotel rooms and cushy jobs, I kind of delayed that. I pushed it to the back of my mind. I was enjoying myself. But after my friend died, I had a sense that I had cheated the system. And when I got word that I was being sent to Iraq, it felt as if I was being asked to make a balance in the difference in the price we'd been asked to pay.
And so what were your first impressions when you got off that plane, you got to Iraq?
Well, it's a bit like space travel. And I think that's a reason for the disconnect and a lot of the conflict that has arisen in our relationships with the Iraqi people. Because you enter this aircraft and the doors close and you spend hours and hours traveling. When the doors open, and you're hit with this wave of otherworldly heat, and the landscape is different, and the people are different. And it's as if you're not responsible for anything you do there, because you know it's going to end. You know you're going to go home, or you assume, you hope that you're going to go home. And so there is a perception that it's not part of this world. And
you write in the book, too, that your sense of yourself was a little unrealistic, that you felt somehow indestructible.
I did. My experience of war before then was based on our culture. These movies which never really show the destruction of human bodies, and we are surrounded with euphemisms of what war is, and we are told war is the defense of freedom, democracy. But war is a thing that is done to civilian populations, and it is the death of children, it's the destruction of families, it's years of trauma, destroyed economies, and my own life has definitely been changed. After I returned, and a big motivation for writing this book is that my mind is filled with chaos, and it was easier to write what I was feeling, to try and gel things and come to terms with them, than speaking about it, because I think the voice adds another layer of sense to reality. To hear the words in your own ear of what you've done, it's hard to come to terms with.
What was your mission in Iraq?
Well, psychological operations is basically propaganda, and our mission was to be the voice of the commander on the battlefield through harassment, deception, dissemination of handbills, pamphlets. I was a pay agent for the small rewards program, where we would pay people for information on where weapons caches were. We would talk to village leaders, attempt to sway them.
What was the turning point for you? When did you begin to think differently about your mission and to think differently about war?
I think it was within the first few days. Initially, I'd been very excited. You know, the equipment was exciting. You know, I was living the life of a so-called hero, and I felt good. I felt powerful. But our first mission was to a city called Barwana on the Euphrates, and we did a harassment broadcast that night of cats fighting in an attempt to irk any insurgents who might have been there.
So this is not a radio broadcast. This is a loudspeaker broadcast, or is it over
yes,
the
we
radio?
Have, we have a 6-cone speaker on top of our trucks at that time, and we were conducting our relief in place with the other team. So we did not have our own truck at that time, but we went up to a rooftop to do security over the river, as we were separated from Haqlania by a little pontoon bridge, which wasn't heavy enough for our trucks to cross it. So we were sort of expected to be attacked, and we deliberately broadcast a harassment broadcast of cats fighting, babies crying, rock music, to draw people out. And we received fire over the course of a few days, and RPGs, mortar, and that was the first time I thought that I would die. That's a difficult thing to confront, your mortality in your 20s. But
is that what did it for you? I mean, it seems to me it is one thing to suddenly realize, oh, wait, I can die. But throughout the book, you talk about a whole change of mind and a change of understanding of what the mission was and sort of why you were there and the disconnect between what soldiers are told and, in fact, what's going on.
Right. The actual moment, I think, was when we had spotted what we thought was an insurgent moving to the river. I, to this day, do not know if it was a human being or if it was a branch blowing in the wind. But everyone who was there assembled on this rooftop and started firing. And it was indiscriminate. And exhilarating to me at first. And then I thought about it and what was going on, and the fact that there were people in those houses, and I felt this overpowering guilt. I felt I was a monster. Well, I really couldn't reveal that to anyone at the time. But I tried to be as humane as possible to the people I met after that. And
what did you do? I mean, how do you stay on the front lines with that sensibility, and also the secret that you're having to keep now from the rest of the battalion?
Well, it's a burden, I think, but it also is a bit of a responsibility I felt I had, that I was there and I had this sense of compassion for the people that I didn't recognize in anyone else. And I thought I should stay, show a face of kindness to these people.
When you do psychological operations, I wonder how much that plays a role in your change of thought. I mean, here you are essentially doing propaganda. You're trying to change people's minds. And I often wonder if people in that business ever think, hey, wait, are they doing this to me?
I analyze everything I see. Do this training. I analyze commercials, the news, and everything is an influence game. In my last tour of Iraq, I was in an office managing a website. It was part of a program called the Trans-Regional Web Initiative. And we would handpick stories to show the coalition in a positive light. We would handpick the comments that came from our readers to demonstrate support for the occupation. And I saw how easy it was to change public perception, and it made me realize that this is going on in other countries. This is going on in our own country. And it really makes me question what's true and what's not. What's the aim of everything?
Well, you make an interesting point in the book. You describe a scene when you're coming back from your tour in Iraq. You're on a bus going through Washington, D.C., looking at those formidable granite buildings and the strength and the power that they convey, those furious statues again, conveying the might of the United States. And then you notice the neglected neighborhoods behind them and the homeless people walking in front of them. And it's a kind of a moment of recognition for you.
Right. I've come to a realization in recent years that our spending priorities are absolutely not where they should be. We can communicate with a rover on Mars. We can send a phone call to the top of Mount Everest, Skype with anybody in the world who has an internet connection. It is not a matter of technological ability to talk with world leaders to resolve our issues. It's a matter of will. A large portion of our tax dollars go to the perpetuation of this world occupation, when I feel that we'd be better served by investing in education, infrastructure, getting ourselves out of 25th place in the world in math and science. We will have a future generation of world leaders who can resolve these conflicts, thereby allowing us to reduce spending, cut down our deficit.
Here's the argument. Let me stop you there for a moment. Yeah. The argument is, look, the minute we do that, there are a lot of bad people out there who will use civilian populations as shields. That's how ruthless they are. And if we don't take some of those chances and allow ourselves to make some of those mistakes, the infrastructure you're talking about improving, the schools that you're talking about building up, won't even be here. We have to defend ourselves against that threat first before we can talk about this. That's the argument.
I think that's a fallacy. We are not war-averse the way the rest of the world is. If you look at Korea, if you look at Germany, you look at Russia, there's still a generational understanding of what it means to have your country destroyed. People are not in a rush to go to war like the United States, which has had only a very small portion of its population experience what that means. We spend more than the top 10 of our next highest defense spenders combined. We would have to drastically cut our defense spending to even come close to the next highest. President Clinton referred to it as the peace dividend of what we could achieve with all that extra money that's being spent on defense. And the end result will be a better perception of the United States if we invest in development, if we invest in improving our relationship with the international community. That will make it less necessary to have all that spending on bombs. And we've created a new generation of terrorists through this war on terror.
Have you found it difficult to readjust to civilian life?
I have. I returned from my second tour. I'd been married. And after 15 months, I came home to an empty house. I kind of withdrew into myself. I turned to heavy drinking, high-risk behaviors. I had less regard for my own life. I had less fear, less healthy fear. I was driving too fast. I slept with a gun under my pillow. I had to take a long, hard look at myself and realize that that was not sustainable. And I was a bit of a hypocrite, telling people it's going to be okay, trying to give people a sense of hope through this book, that through their own will they can come to terms with themselves.
That's when you turned it around for yourself personally. And is that your goal for this book? Tell us what that is.
My goal, first of all, was to help myself. It's not initially intended as something I wanted to publish. It was something to help myself understand what I had become. Secondly, it was intended to show people who'd been in that experience that theirs was not unique, that they were not alone in suffering, that there was a path to redemption, so to say. And third, I think, was to strip clear all these euphemisms of what the war was and show it for what it really is.
What has it done for you, this book? Obviously, it brought you to a place very deep inside yourself. You had to do an examination. I'm guessing you discovered things that you hadn't expected to find and perhaps didn't like to find.
Well, I think I found some strength in myself I didn't know I had. I found a much deeper appreciation for life. It actually feels like a second life because I had so come to terms with the inevitability of my own death that I really didn't care. I had stopped planning. And I think, to a degree, the reason I kept the journal upon which this book is based was because I wanted my family to have something from me to understand what I was feeling. Because I wasn't able to talk with them all the time.
Has this made it easier? Can you now talk with them? And can they talk with you? Did they find it difficult to talk with you, subjects they didn't want to get near, that sort of thing?
I never discussed this with my family before I'd written this book, and I shared it with my dad. And he said it made him cry. It's not easy to share, but I think it's important to share because, you know, I'll use another quote. I quote President Kennedy in the very beginning, something along the lines of, if we do not end war, war will end humanity. And I think we're edging ever closer to that through globalization. Borders are getting closer. Our exposure to international media is making us more aware of what people think. That leads to conflict. And if we can't find a way to resolve conflict civilly, we're going to be in a bad place.
Russell, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
Russell Snyder is the author of Hearts and Minds, With the Marines at Ellen Barr, the story of psychological warfare. You can find out more at casematepublishers.com. Stay with us. There's more of The State of Things just ahead.